The Last American, a fragment from the journal of Khan Li, Prince of Dinfyuchur and Admiral in the Persian Navy, presented by J. A. Mitchell. Copyright 1899. 20th of June. Once more we are on the sea, 2 days from New York. Our decision was a sudden one. Nofel, in an evil moment, found among those accursed plates a map of the country, and thereupon was seized with an unreasoning desire to visit a town called Washington. I wavered and at last consented, foolishly, I believe, for the crew are loud for Persia. And this town is an island on a river. He says it was their finest city, the seat of government, the capital of the country. Griptila swears he can find it if the map is truthful. Jakaz still eats by himself. This afternoon we reclined upon deck, the Zlotub drifting gently in a southerly direction. Land could be seen on the starboard bow, a faint strip along the western horizon. It was about the middle of the afternoon when, passing the ruins of a gigantic tower, perhaps a lighthouse, that Nofel, of a sudden, clambered hastily to his feet and looked about him. Then he called to Griptila, asking how many leagues we were from the harbor of New York. Griptila's reply, I forget, but it filled the old man with a gentle excitement. I observed an unwanted sparkle in his eyes. Also a quivering of the fingers as he pointed to the ocean around about and exclaimed, "Beneath us, the bottom of the sea is covered with iron ships, the wrecks of stupendous navies, the mightiest of all human history." At once we all became interested. "What navies?" I inquired. "And what compassed their destruction? Was it a battle?" Nofel, "A battle of whose magnitude no Persian has conception. A conflict in which the sea was tossed and the heavens rent by thunderings of iron monsters. Any one of them would have blown to atoms a fleet of Zlotubs."
Adalpate, "Verily, a tale easier told than believed, but I would readily venture my head in the Zlotub against any of these nursery tale wonders."
Nofel, "And with wisdom, for the loss of thy brain, Adalpate, could not affect the nature of thy speech." Whereupon there was laughter, and Adalpate held his peace. Khan Li, "But tell us of this battle, O Nofel. I remember now to have read about it at college. These details of ancient history I am prone to forget. How came it about?"
Nofel,
"I have spoken of the Americans being a greedy race, and their greed at last resulted in this war. By means of one-sided laws of their own making, they secured for themselves a lion's share of all profits from the world's commerce. This checked the prosperity of other nations, until at last the leading powers of Europe combined in self-defense against this all-absorbing greed. They collected an armada, the like of which was never imagined neither before nor since. Then, across the ocean came the Iron Host, and here, upon this very spot, where we are floating, they met the American ships."
Khan Li, "How many ships in all?"
Nofel, "The Americans had 80 heavy ships of iron, with a number of smaller craft. The Allies had 240 heavy battleships, all of iron. They also had smaller craft for diverse purposes."
Khan Li, "Allah, a bad prospect for our greedy friends, and being a nation of traders, they had no liking, probably, for the perils of war."
Nofel, "As to that, historians differ. According to the Americans themselves, they were mighty warriors, but certain writers of that period give a different impression. Nozit Al is sure they were cowards, weak in body as in spirit, but often favored by fortune. In my opinion, this battle throws considerable light upon that matter." A day like this it was, also in June, as the Europeans coming northward along the coast to seize New York met the American Admiral Navrasidi with his 80 ships, and the struggle was short.
Khan Li, "Verily, I can believe it. With 3 ships to 1, I would give the Europeans about half a day, a summer afternoon like this, to send the greedy ones to the bottom."
Nofel, "Thy guess is good, O Prince. As to the hours of fighting, it lasted just 1 summer afternoon, but the Americans it was who sent their enemies to the bottom, and the sea beneath our feet is strewn with iron hulks."
Khan Li, "Bismillah! If that is a true tale, and I doubt it not, these greedy ones were not so contemptible, at least when there was profit in it."
Level Hadid, "At what period did this occur?"
Nofel,
"Early in the 20th century. I cannot recall the date, but it was never forgotten by the Americans. Surely a just pride, for on that day they accomplished wonders. The Admiral Navrasidi, on his ship the Zazentripes, was at one time surrounded by 12 German men of war, and lo, he demolished all. And of Frank and Russian vessels he put an end to as many more, also sundry Italians and British." Level Hadid.
Bismillah, that was good. What, O Nofal, is the Persian of that name, Zazin Stripes?
Nofal. None can say with certainty. To the Medicans, it signified victory, or something similar.
Other miracles were achieved by the Medicans that day.
Nofli Zonmi, a little craft with a pointed prow, jammed holes in nearly a score of monster ships, and the waters closed over them. There figured also a long and narrow boat of American devising. The Yankid Odo. This astonishing machine sailed to and fro among the foreign ships, upsetting all traditions. Much glory befell her commander, the Captain Haurei Boyce.
Griptilla. And how many ships did the Medicans lose?
Nofal. Reports are contradictory. According to one of their own writers of the period, they suffered no loss whatever in vessels. Yet, at the same time, he asserts, we gave them Helicolumbia, which must be the name of a ship.
Khan Lee. A gallant fight. But can you explain how such an inferior people could become Suruk of a sudden?
Nofal. According to Ardfax, an early British historian, they were addicted to surprising feats upon the water. And this statement is borne out by Spanish Admiral Ofelbad Shuta, who maintains that the Medicans were being godless people, were aided by the devil.
July 2nd. We are on the river that leads to Washington. Griptilla says we shall sight it tomorrow. The river is a dirty color.
3rd of July. We see ahead of us the ruins of a great dome, and also a very high shaft. Probably they belong to the city we seek.
4th of July. A date we shall not forget. Little did I realize this morning when we left the Zlotub in such hilarious mood what dire events awaited us. I landed about noon, accompanied by Nofal, Level Hadid, Bozjakaz, Adalpate, Kuzundum, the first mate, Tikalpalit, the cook, Fatanazi, and two sailors. Our march had scarce begun when a startling discovery caused great commotion in our minds. We had halted at Nofal's request to decipher the inscription upon a stone, when Level Hadid, who had started on, stopped short with a sudden exclamation. We hastened to him, and there, in the soft earth, was the imprint of human feet. I cannot describe our surprise. We decided to follow the footprints, and soon they found they were leading us toward the great dome more directly than we could have gone ourselves. Our excitement was beyond words. Those of us who had weapons carried them in readiness. The path was little used, but clearly marked. It wound among fallen fragments and crumbling statues, and took us along a wide avenue between buildings of vast size and solidity, far superior to any we had seen in New York. It seemed a city of monuments. We ascended the hill to the great temple and saw it through the trees rising high above us. We were much impressed by the vast size and beauty. Our eyes wandered in admiration over the massive columns, each hewn from a single block, still white and fresh as if newly quarried. The path took us under one of the lower arches of the building, and we emerged on the other side. This front we found even more beautiful than the one facing the city. At the center was a flight of steps of magnificent proportions, now falling asunder and overgrown in many places with grass and flowers. These steps we ascended. As I climbed silently up, the others following us, I saw two human feet, the soles toward us, resting upon the balustrade above. With a gesture, I directed Nofal's attention to them, and the old man's eyes twinkled with delight. Was it American? I confessed to a lively excitement at the prospect of meeting one. How many were they, and how would they treat us? Looking down upon my little band to see that all were there, I boldly marched up the remaining steps and stood before him. He was reclining upon a curious little four-legged seat, with his feet up upon the balustrade, about on a level with his head. Clad in skins and rough cloth, he looked much like a hunter, and he gazed quietly upon me, as though a Persian noble were his daily guest. Such a reception was not gratifying, especially as he had remained in the same position, not even withdrawing his feet. He nodded his curious head down once and up again, deeming it apparently a sufficient salutation. The maintenance of my own dignity before my followers forbade my standing thus before a seated barbarian, and I made a gesture for him to rise. This he answered in an unseemly manner by ejecting from his mouth a brownish fluid, projecting it over and beyond the balustrade in front of him. Then looking upon me as if about to laugh, and yet with a grave face, he uttered something in an unmusical voice which I failed to understand. Upon this, Nofel, who had caught the meaning of one or two words, stepped hastily forward and addressed him in his own language. But the barbarian understood with difficulty, and they had much trouble in conversing, chiefly from reason of Nofel's pronunciation. Afterward, he told me that this man's language differed but little from that of the Americans, as they wrote it 11 centuries ago. When he finally arose in talking with Nofel, I could better observe him. He was tall and bony, with an awkward neck, and appeared at first glance to be a man of 40 years. We decided later he was under 30. His yellow skin and want of hair made him seem much older than he was. I was also much puzzled by the expression on his face. It was one of deep sadness, yet his eyes were full of mirth, and a corner of his mouth was ever drawing up as if in mockery. For myself, I liked not his manner. He appeared little impressed by so many strangers, and bore himself as though it was of small importance whether or not we understood him. But Nofel since informed me that he asked a multitude of questions concerning us. What Nofel gathered was this. This American, with his wife and one old man, were all that remained of his race. 31 had died this summer. In ancient times there were many millions of his countrymen. They were the greatest nation upon the earth. He could not read. He had two names. One was John, the other he had forgotten. They lived in this temple because it was cool. When the temple was built, and for what purpose, he could not tell. He pointed to the west and said the country in that direction was covered with ruined cities. When Nofel told him we were friends, and presented him at my direction with a hunting knife of fine workmanship, he pushed out his right arm toward me and held it there. For an instant, Nofel looked at the arm wonderingly, as did we all. Then, with sudden intelligence, he seized the outstretched hand in his own and moved it up and down. This is interesting, for Nofel tells me it was a form of greeting among ancient Americans. While all this was going on, we had moved into the great circular hall beneath the dome. This hall was of vast proportions, and there were still traces of its former splendor. Against the walls were marble statues entwined in ivy, looking down upon us with melancholy eyes. Here also we met a thin, old man, whose hairless head and beardless face almost moved us to mirth. At Nofel's request, our host led the way into some of the smaller rooms to show us their manner of living, and it would be impossible to imagine a more pathetic mixture of glory and decay, of wealth and poverty, of civilization and barbarity. Old furniture, dishes of silver, bronze images, even paintings and ornaments of great value were scattered through the rooms, side by side with the most primitive implements. It was plain that ancient arts were long since forgotten. When we returned to the circular hall, our host disappeared for a few moments into a room which he had not shown us. He came back bringing a stone vase with a narrow neck, and was followed by a maiden who bore drinking cups of copper and tin. These he deposited upon a fallen fragment of the dome which served as a table. The girl was interesting, a dainty head, delicate features, yellow hair, blue eyes, and a gentle sadness of mien that touched my heart. Had she been ugly, what a different ending to this day. We all saluted her, and the American spoke a few words which we interpreted as a presentation. He filled the cups from the stone vase, and then saying something which Nofel failed to catch, he held his cup before his face with a peculiar movement and put it to his lips. As he did this, Level Hadid clutched my arm and exclaimed, "The very gesture of the ghost!" And then, as if to himself, "And this is July 4th. But he drank, as did we all, for our thirst was great, and the odor of the golden liquid was most alluring. It tasted hotter than the fires of Djelbuz. It was also of great potency, and gave a fine exhilaration to the senses. We became happier at once. And here it was that Jahkaz did a fatal thing. Being near the maid, and much affected by her beauty, he addressed her as Hur al-Misa, the most angelic of women, which, of course, she understood not. This were well had he gone no further, but he next put his arm around her waist with intent to kiss her. Much terrified, she tried to free herself. But Jahkaz, holding her fair chin with his other hand, had brought his lips almost to hers when the old man raised his heavy staff and brought it down upon our comrade's head with cruel swiftness. This falling stick upon a solid skull resounded about the dome and echoed through the empty corridors. Boz Jahkaz blinked and staggered back. Then, with fury in his face, he sprang savagely toward the aged man. But here the younger American interfered. Rapidly approaching them and shutting tight his bony hand, he shot it from him with startling velocity, so directing that it came in contact with the face of Jahkaz, who, to our amazement, sat roughly upon the marble pavement, the blood streaming from his nostrils. He was a pitiful sight. Unaccustomed to such warfare, we were seriously alarmed, and thought him killed, perhaps. Adalpate, a mighty wrestler and of powerful build, rushed furiously upon the American, for whom I trembled. But his arm again went out before him, and Adalpate likewise sat, a mournful spectacle, and every Persian felt his heart beat fast within him. By this time Jacaz was on his feet again, purple with rage. With uplifted scimitar he sprang toward our host. The old man stepped between. Jacaz, with wanton cruelty, brought his steel upon the ancient head and stretched him upon the floor. For an instant the younger one stood horror-stricken. Then, snatching from the floor the patriarch's staff, a heavy stick with an iron end, he jumped forward, and quicker than words can tell it, dealt a frightful blow upon the head of Jacaz, which sent him headlong to the ground with a broken skull. All this had happened in a moment, and wild confusion followed. My followers drew their arms and rushed upon the Medican. The girl ran forward from either terror or to shield her spouse, I know not which, when a flying arrow from a sailor's crossbow pierced her heart. This gave the Medican the energy of 20 men. He knocked brave Kuzundam senseless with a blow that would have killed an ox. Such fury I had not conceived. He brought his flying staff like a thunderbolt from heaven upon the Persian skulls, yet always edging toward the door to prevent his enemies surrounding him. Four of our number and his many menace joined Jacaz upon the floor. Kuzundam, Adalpate, Fatanaize, and Hatak, a sailor, lay stretched upon the pavement, all dead or grievously wounded. So suddenly had this taken place that I hardly realized what had happened. I rushed forward to stay the combat, but he mistook the purpose, struck my scimitar with a force that sent it flying through the air, and had raised his staff to deal a second for myself when brave Level Hadid stepped in to save me, and thrust quickly at him. But alas, the Medican warded off his stroke with one yet quicker, and brought his stick so swiftly against my comrade's head that it laid him with all the others. When Level Hadid fell, I saw the Medican had many wounds, for my comrades had made a savage onslaught. He tottered as he moved back into the doorway, where he leaned against the wall for an instant, his eyes meeting ours with a look of defiance and contempt that I would willingly forget. Then the staff dropped from his hand. He staggered out to the great portico and fell his length upon the pavement. Nofal hastened to him, but he was dead. As he fell, a wonderful thing took place, an impossible thing, as I look back upon it, but both Nofal and I saw it distinctly. In front of the great steps and facing this doorway is a large sitting image of George Washington. As the Medican staggered out upon the porch, his hands outstretched before him and with death at his heart, this statue slowly bowed its head as if in recognition of a gallant fight. Perhaps it was the sorrowful acceptance of a bitter ending. July 7th. Again upon the sea. This time for Persia, bearing our wounded and the ashes of the dead. Those of the natives are reposing beneath the great temple. The skull of the last Medican I shall present to the museum in Tehran. A few historical notes on this last section. The high shaft that they see while they're approaching the city of Washington, D.C., is, I believe it to be the Washington Monument, which was built in 1848. It was built to celebrate the 100th anniversary of George Washington's birth. And the giant temple that they find the last American in is the White House, which was... They started building it in 1793, didn't really finish it until 1807. It was also partially burned in the War of 1812 by the British, who we were at war with, and much of it had to be repaired, which took a while. It was painted white. A lot of people say it was painted white to cover the burn marks from being burned in the War of 1812, but that's not actually true. It was painted white before the War of 1812 because a lot of it was made from sandstone and was to protect the sandstone from water and freezing, although the name White House didn't become popular until into the early 20th century. Another thing I'd like to mention is a lot of the Persian, so-called Persian names in this book are puns. I made a conscious effort not to pronounce them so that it would be immediately obvious what the pun was, because I found when I was reading it for the first time, once I knew the puns, it kind of distracted from my enjoyment of the book, the puns. Maybe I'm just not a person who really likes puns all that much.
But the historian who introduces the book, Headful, I think, you know, a full head, I think, and the prince, the main character of the prince, he's a noble of Dim Future, which is Dim Future. The scholar that he brings with him is Noz Ital, Knows It All. The Zlotub, their ship, is the Slow Tub. Level Hadid, the one of the sailors, is level headed. Bozjakaz, I have to believe from his behavior that it's a jackass. Fat and lazy. And the ship's cook, Tickle Palit, tickle your palate. No Full, I'm not too sure about, but maybe his head is not full. And Kuzundam and Connolly, the main characters, I'm not sure if those are puns at all. If they are, I can't figure them out.